All right, let's move on into the text that we have. And we're now into Genesis chapter 11. You might say, well, gee, it's left out half of Genesis chapter 10, but we're going to pick that up as we go through Genesis 11. Because one of the things you note here is that Genesis 11 puts you back a little bit chronologically. So Genesis 10 is a little bit out of the chronology, in that what you have is Moses taking a moment to say, okay, this is the story of Noah, and we're going to move from Noah to Abraham, and he kind of gives you a sweep of history between Noah and Abraham in Genesis chapter 10. And it's basically what happened to Noah's sons, and where the different sons, grandsons, great-sons, grandsons, and their descendants settled. But Genesis chapter 11 talks about this event of how it got to be that the human species finally began to pay some attention to the command that God had been giving ever since Genesis chapter 1. And just by way of review, I've hit this before, what is the most repeated command that God gives to the human species in the book of Genesis? Be fruitful and multiply. He says it twice in Genesis 1, two more times in Genesis chapter 9. You are to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, going back to Genesis chapter 1, why do we have God giving that command to Adam twice and then to Noah twice? Genesis chapter 1 explains why that command was so important. Okay, anyone? Okay. Because humans don't listen. Okay, that's why I had to give it four times. Humans weren't listening. There's a reason why they weren't listening. We'll find in Genesis chapter 11. But what was God's rationale behind the command? Why did he want them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth? Right. Genesis 1:28, the command was that Adam and Eve and their descendants were to subdue the earth. They were to take care of all the life on the planet. And if you read on into verses 29 and 30, it's that the human species was given the responsibility to manage the resources of the entire planet for all life. And you notice at the very end of verse 30, he says, green plants are the basis of food for all life. And so, hey, in managing the resources of the planet for the benefit of all life, be careful to take good care of the green plants. Because if you don't take care of the green plants, nobody gets to eat. Green plants are the base of the food chain. There's nothing in Genesis 1 that says that there are no carnivorous animals. In fact, if you go back into the sixth creation day, it makes a contrast between land mammals that are wild and land mammals that are domesticatable, one referring to the herbivores, the other to the carnivores. So there was carnivorous activity before Adam and Eve existed, but nevertheless, carnivores, just as much as herbivores, are fundamentally dependent on green plants. By the way, there are plants that are not green, and people eat those, and herbivores eat those. But the non-green plants cannot survive without the green plants. The herbivores can't survive without the green plants, and neither can the carnivores. Yeah, all life on planet Earth is dependent upon those green plants. They're the only life forms that are capable of making food from sunlight and water and carbon dioxide. So green plants is this base of the food chain. But in order for the human species to really fulfill that command to manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit of all life, they obviously have to occupy the whole planet. It's not going to do any good if all you got are people living in Australia, because then you won't be able to carefully manage the resources of Africa, Asia, or North and South America. So God's intent all along was that the human species would be globally distributed, and distributed in large enough numbers that, number one, they would know what life forms exist on the planet, and they would know what each of those life forms would require. And you kind of see that in the book of books of Solomon, both Ecclesiastes and of Proverbs, men of God were motivated to study the different plants and animal species on the face of the earth and see how God has provided for them, and therefore how we human beings can be partners with God in ensuring a good existence for all the species of life on the planet. And therefore, you're going to need a minimum number of people to do that, and you're going to need them globally distributed. You know, one context, we're not even at first base. I find it interesting that even in the 21st century, we've yet to catalog all the plant and animal species on the face of the planet. In fact, some biologists feel that we've only cataloged maybe just 25%. We don't even know for sure how many species of life are on the planet. We say maybe there are 4 million, some say 10 million, some say maybe 30 million. I've even heard numbers as high as 40 million. I think somewhere around 10 million is probably within reason. But it is interesting when you read the scientific literature that there is a debate that runs anywhere from 5 to 40 as to how many millions of species are on the face of the earth. So in that sense, you know, we haven't even gotten to the first step of being able to ascertain what we need to do to benefit all life on planet Earth. So that's why God said, multiply and fill the earth. Now we're going to discover in Genesis chapter 11, there's a second reason why God wanted the human species to multiply and occupy the entire planet. It's something that's good for human beings, given that they're experiencing sin. So we'll be getting into that. In other words, staying in one place, having a small population, we'll look at the goals of humanity in Genesis chapter 11. It's interesting that what we see in Genesis chapter 11 is really the same goals that you hear in United Nations speeches. So this isn't anything that has been taken care of by any means. So the problems of Genesis chapter 11 are still with us today. But I've got a couple of questions to ask you before we get into these fundamental problems. According to Genesis 11, where did the ark land? And then another question, were there biodeposits before the flood? What does Genesis 6 and 11 say? So those are two questions I like to ask that are right in the beginning of the chapter, and then we'll move on from there to the problems of humanity and how they exist today and what God did about it and what Genesis chapter 10 says that God has done about this problem. So we'll be dipping back into Genesis 10, the last few verses, as we work our way through Genesis 11. So, according to Genesis 11, where did the ark land? Yes. On the mountains of Ararat. That's what Genesis chapter 8 tells us, that the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And what are those mountains? Or where are those mountains? Northern Iraq, Turkey, Russia, Syria. The problem is that the mountains of Ararat cover about 100 to 150,000 square miles. So it doesn't exactly pin down the location of Noah's Ark very carefully. But it is important to note, if you were to ask most people where Noah's Ark came to rest, they would say, oh, on top of Mount Ararat. But the text doesn't say that. It doesn't say Mount Ararat. It says the mountains of Ararat. And the Hebrew word for mountains is the same word for hills. So you're looking at a region that really is bigger than the traditional territory of Armenia. Armenians refer to their homeland as the mountains of Ararat. So we're looking at 100 to 150,000 square miles. I'm going to draw a little map on the blackboard so that you can see. But what has this text got to say? Yes. Somewhere east of the plains of Shinar, and unfortunately Shinar is well established as a geographical location in the Bible. Anybody can tell us what is this plain of Shinar? Yeah, you had a comment?
Just
Yeah, that would be James Irwin. He claimed to have found remains of Noah's Ark on top of Mount Ararat, but the claim, I can tell you, is not credible. I've talked to Jim myself before he died, and there was no... I haven't... No, it is James Irwin that did make the claim that he had found evidence for Noah's Ark, but the evidence that he found was not credible evidence. It was like photographs, and it was showing these shapes that looked like Noah's Ark, but when you got up close, you discovered it was simply a geological incline. And it looked impressive to people that are not used to alpine geology, but if you go into alpine regions, you see these... layers of rock that that get twisted into kind of a semicircle. And so layers that were like this will get deformed by tectonic activity so that they actually look like the bow of a ship. And hey, all you got to do is go into the high Sierras here and you'll find better arcs in the high Sierras than what you'll find anywhere near Mount Ararat itself. So, but yeah, he showed this little photograph where it looked like this boat was sticking out of the rock or a glacier, but in fact it's just simply an incline. It's nothing. Well, it was Jim Irwin's claim that with this space technology we have, we can photograph Mount Ararat so carefully and so definitively that we'll be able to uncover Noah's Ark. And he kind of hinted that the best photographs aren't being released to the public because they're CIA controlled, and that you know, really we already have the evidence. But you know, Mark Clark, for example, who's part of our team and works with the strategic studies, says there's no basis to that claim. He has friends who have looked at the photographs and say there's nothing there. But all you got to do is look at the Bible. The Bible doesn't say the ark comes to rest on Mount Ararat. It's the mountains of Ararat. And so people, in my opinion, are looking in the wrong place. You're not going to find the ark on top of Mount Ararat. You're going to find it in the foothills of Ararat. And, you know, we studied the texts about how high the water could possibly have risen. Maximum height is around 500 or 600 feet above the plain of Shinar. Back to the plain of Shinar. I knew we would get back there sooner or later, is how high that water could have gone. But all around the plain of Shinar, you've got these mountains of Ararat. Okay, I think before I take any more questions, I'm going to put a map on the blackboard, and then we'll be able to see what's going on here. Anyway, my whole point is that maybe this region where goat domestication or wheat domestication took place may have been the locations where villages were built, where the timbers of Noah's Ark would have been used. But yeah, I would say your best chance for finding evidence for Noah's Ark is to look in the ashes of the destroyed cities and the destroyed villages. But that's the best I think you're going to find are the burnt ashes of the timbers from Noah's Ark. And of course, trying to sift through those burnt ashes and identify it with the ark is going to be really difficult, if not impossible. So in my opinion, I would suggest that find different sources to donate your money to than to expeditions to find Noah's Ark. My humble opinion, it's a waste of money to mount an expedition to look for Noah's Ark. And you say, well, how much money is being spent by Christians on this? I think you'd be utterly shocked at how much money has been spent over the 30 years looking for these remains of Noah's Ark, where there's really no hope from the biblical perspective of finding such remains. Sure, there's no chromium here. So if you want to have chromium supplements for your diet, then you're going to have to go somewhere besides the plains of Shinar. That's a very good point, that God wanted to bless humanity. And not all the blessings of humanity are located in this plain of Shinar. I mean, it is a fertile valley, and it is loaded with resources. And we're going to discover some of the resources in the text. But it's not everything that God had intended for humanity. But also we're going to discover there's a spiritual reason why God didn't want humanity just dwelling in the plains of Shinar, and that becoming global would help deal with these spiritual problems. I think you were next. That would have them moving this direction. That is an alternate reading of the text. Another one is that they moved eastward, into Shinar or from Shinar. I mean, so it is a little bit confusing. And I did do a little bit of study on that last night, and most scholars feel that the interpretation that I'm offering here and the one that you find in the translations, yours is probably in a footnote, right?
No.
No, it's actually in the text. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the other translations say they migrated this way. So, but, I mean, there is a debate on it, but most people are falling. It doesn't really matter to that degree, right? Okay, yes. Well, I mean, I think that's a good point, that finding evidence of Noah's Ark, would that substantially add to the proof that we have of what's being recorded here in Genesis? Just like finding timbers from the cross of Jesus, would that substantially add to the evidence of his crucifixion? And I think, in large sense, the answer is no. It's not going to add substantially. So, but reason I raise this is that, you know, when you give people an opportunity to ridicule Christian evidences where the evidences really don't exist, that may give them some justification to say, well, maybe all these evidences. So there's a real need in this case for the Christian community to police their own apologetics rather than letting the atheists point out how bad this stuff is. You know, that's what disappointed me about the special that was on television a couple of years ago on the search for Noah's Ark. It was produced by Christians, but there was nothing in the two-hour documentary that was at all critical of the evidences being presented, and that just gave the atheists a field day to come on television and say, look how stupid these Christians are, this is totally bogus, and therefore, you know, we shouldn't allow these evangelicals to do any more of these productions on television because they can't be trusted. And it's sad from my perspective, because many of us had warned the producers that this was going to happen, and they should at least put a little bit of, bring in some people that are a little bit critical from within the Christian community. But that wasn't done. Well, that's a good question, because what we have is a local population in the days before the flood, and you say, well, if murder was that far to control, why not move away from the murderers? Maybe people did try to do that. On the other hand, the people you move away with may have been the problem. So, if everybody's trying to kill you, there's nowhere to go, right? I mean, that's a good question, but the text doesn't get specific on it. Yes. You mean that people are friendlier living in the Northwest Territories than they are in the middle of New York City? Okay. Yeah, when your nearest neighbor is 5 miles away, then you tend to put a little more value on human contact than cab drivers in New York City. Okay. So, what was that movie I said where this guy was walking in New York City from the outback of Australia, and he says, all these people living this close together must be a really friendly place. And he found out otherwise. Okay. Let's move on to the second question. But I just wanted you to understand that Genesis 11 does give us some perspective on where the ark may have possibly have landed, not on top of Mount Ararat. I mean, regardless of how you interpret that passage, were they moving eastward or from the east into this area, it's nowhere near Mount Ararat. Mount Ararat would have been to the north and not east or west. So it does give you some additional support that this mountains of Ararat referred to in Genesis 8:4 is a very large geographical area. And then the fact that we see the origin of wheat and goat domestication, again, considerably distant from Mount Ararat itself. As we were in Genesis chapter 9, we noted that there is a debate within the Christian community on things like coal, oil, natural gas, tars. And this text makes mention of tar, just like Genesis 6 made mention of tar. And really the center of the debate is, did the flood form all these biodeposits, or were they there long before the flood? And I'm going to suggest that from Genesis 6 and 11, we would have some textual evidence that this stuff was there before the flood. It wasn't made during the flood. And I won't go into all the details. I think we've covered this before. It's simply scientifically impossible to make all the biodeposits in a 13-month period. You can't get enough energy flow from the sun to explain all the chemical energy that will exist in these biodeposits. Even if you were to convert all the energy from the sun with 100% efficiency into these biodeposits, it wouldn't come even close to the total biodeposits of the face of the earth. To put this in context, people have made the point that we Americans right now are consuming at about 1 million years of biodeposit history per year. Every year we go through 1 million years worth of biodeposits. So, you know, the idea that it was made in 13 months is simply not credible at all. Yes. Well, what is the evidence we have here in Genesis chapter 11 that these biodeposits were extensive? Right. It's actually the same word that you have in Genesis chapter 6. Remember in Genesis 6, God told Noah, when you make the ark, you're to make it out of wood, not a gopher wood, and we still don't know exactly what that gopher wood is, except it's very good lumber. And he says you're to seal it with this asphalt, this tar, or this pitch. That's how it was going to be made watertight. And likewise, we note here in Genesis chapter 11 that when the inhabitants of the plain of Shinar begin to build their cities, and Babel in particular in a tower, they used brick instead of stone, verse 3, and tar instead of mortar. Now, when you compare tar to mortar, the motivation for using tar instead of mortar really can only be explained by the fact that this stuff must have been really abundant. If it's not readily available and available in large quantities, you're not going to use a tar. It's just too much trouble. You're going to use the mortar instead. But evidently, this stuff was so plentiful that they used it to seal the bricks together rather than the mortar. And it must have been good quality stuff, too, to be able to provide an adequate seal to build a tower as big as they built this tower. I mean, they're saying they're building it so it can reach to the heavens. It must have been a considerably tall structure, and therefore would have had it been a very good quality of asphalt. But after all, we're well aware that the area of Iraq is rich in those kinds of biodeposits. It may have not just been sunlight form, because that's what the Egyptians would do. They would make their bricks and just kind of bake them in the sun. So what the suggestion you're making, as an artist who's had some personal experience in this, is that they were actually firing these bricks to make them the way they did, and that firing would have meant they would have needed a fuel source, and they would have exploited the oil and that would have been there in that area. Yeah, the word is the same as the one that you have in Genesis 6, where God says to Noah, you're to seal the ark with asphalt, tar, pitch. Those are all the definitions you'll see for the Hebrew word in the lexicon. It could be translated pitch. There's been some debate by Christians who think that all the biodeposits are made during the flood to say, well, maybe it was wood pitch. Well, I would argue that, I mean, you can look up the word in the lexicon, and the three things, the words you see there are tar, asphalt, and pitch. Those are the three definitions of that term. It's more broadly defined than our English word for asphalt. I mean, I would literally look at the word in the Hebrew as referring to any kind of oil deposit that is thick and sticky. So, and you know, I would agree too that it's possible something like pine pitch could fit in with that word, but it may not. there's no question it can refer to tar and asphalt that as an oil residue, but to say that it goes as far as pine pitch, maybe, but it is a maybe. It's not definite. And the slime thing, I don't know. Somebody was trying to make a nice broad term there. I mean, part of the problem in translating from Hebrew into English, you've got these Hebrew words with broad definitions, and then you've got to select an English word, and we don't have appropriate English words that are that broadly defined. So my guess is what the translator is looking for is say, well, since it is broadly defined in the Hebrew, let's find a broadly defined English word, and slime has a broad definition. Well, I mean, some prefer the King James. In fact, there's a Bible translation called the New King James. Okay, and what the New King James has done is say, well, nobody speaks Elizabethan English anymore except people who study Shakespeare. My wife still likes the King James because she's taught Shakespeare when she was an English professor. So, she still likes that translation. But she's one that admits people are not as literate in Elizabethan English as they were 50 years ago. You know, 50 years ago, everybody got taught Shakespeare's plays. It's not possible to get through school these days with only being exposed to maybe one or two of them. There are a few of us who still enjoy the King James. But for the younger generation, they pick up the New King James, which gets rid of all the Elizabethan terminology and puts it into more modern English, but still retains the textual support behind the King James. If you're interested, there's a book out. I don't think it's in our catalog, but it's a book I recommend, and I forget the exact title, but it's a scholar who made a book that comments on all the different high-quality English translations. And he deals with this controversy within the Christian community that it's King James only. Maybe you know the title of the book. Marge, is that what you're going to give me? No, it wasn't the one I was thinking about, but that's another book that deals with this debate that, you know, the King James is the only accurate translation. There are 16 outstanding translations in the English of the Greek and Hebrew original. But hey, if anybody wants to quibble translations, the wonderful thing about being an English speaker is you can get study guides that really will enable you to go right to the original Hebrew and Greek text. You can't do that in all languages, but you can in English. In fact, I've had some people come to class here with these notebook computers where they got this all loaded into their computer. So whenever there's a doubt like this, they just hit a little button and up pops the lexicons. They get the definitions. And they find out how many times this word is used in the Bible, where else it's used in the Bible. I mean, everything you want to know, and then some, you can discover through these English study guides. There's really no basis for saying that one translation is better than the other. They all have their points where they're valuable. People have argued that the King James, the old King James, has the greatest literary beauty in terms of translation. You know, my wife makes that point. If you really understand Elizabethan English, it's got a literary beauty to it that's really remarkable. Retains well the literal beauty of the original Hebrew in particular as it's being translated. But different translations have their points. I mean, someone here commented about the New Living Bible. The Living Bible was put out by a gentleman because his kids couldn't understand the King James that they were reading. So he translated it into colloquial American English. But the problem is colloquial American Bible for those who come from a British background rather than an American background. Now, personally, I own all these translations. And where I like the Phillips or the Living is when I'm trying to work with my kids, for example, on the satire of Elijah, because those translations, colloquial translations, really faithfully bring out the satire that's in the text. Where in the New International Version, the one I got here, a lot of the satire is missing. It doesn't read nearly as funny in the New International Version as it does in the Living Translation. And then I would go to something like the New American Standard Bible if I want to really get a grip on the what the text says in the greatest accuracy possible about the fundamental doctrines of the Christian faith. So, for example, when I'm witnessing to cultists, I have this little Bible, a New American Standard Bible, where I got all the doctrinal points underlined in red ink. And to me, that's the best translation for that kind of purpose. Each translation has its range where it's appropriate. And I highly recommend that you read the foreword for every translation of the Bible. You know, this New International Version's got a two-page foreword, which describes who translated it and what they were trying to translate from the original and what they had to let go of. You know, certain things don't make it into the translation, but other things do. And, you know, every Bible typically will give you a foreword where it kind of gives you the biases of the translators. Now, Marge, you had another point to make. Back to the tar, yes. Sounds like it means tar, right. This isn't pine pitch. So, yeah, when you get into the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, evidently they had access to these bio deposits as well. Yeah, very. You could say, well, well, it's true, but you actually will find the word translation in the front piece of these Bibles. And actually, I would argue it's just simply an acknowledgement of how wealthy we are as English language speakers in terms of Bible translation. We have 16 outstanding translations. The most you find in any other language is 2. We have 16. Everybody else has to make do with 1 or 2. And so, but that's because there's a lot more demand for that within the English language than the other languages. It's also because the other languages really don't permit that wealth of detail in translation. It only works because the English language has such a huge vocabulary that you can develop all these different translations that bring out different nuances from the original. Whereas if you're working with a French language, we discover that the French vocabulary is so limited in terms of its size, you really can't develop the same breadth of translation detail in French as you can in English. So yeah, in the French language, they have just 2 translations. They got the Old French and the New French, and that's it. Yeah, if you want to quibble the details, you got to do that, right? I mean, particularly when people are arguing these scientific details. I mean, was there oil and coal in the days before the flood or not? Hey, you better read it in the original if you really want to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, as we've been discussing here in class, these words show up in a variety of places in the Old Testament. You're not just dependent on one text. Look them all up, and I think you've got a convincing case. This can't be just pine pitch. You know, as Marge pointed out, it shows up in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Or pardon me, it wasn't the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's a story about the 4 kings going against the 5 kings, I believe, where they run into those tar pits. That's the story. Yeah, Chedorlaomer and the 4 kings going against the 5 kings of the Sodomites, and how the Chedorlaomer was able to you know, win a victory because they were falling into these tar pits. So it can't be just pine pitch. It's got to be real biodeposits. Okay, we got a few minutes left. Let me kind of set the stage for when I get back here in class in the middle of August. The whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone, and tar instead of mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we can make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." So there's the motivation of humanity at that time. They did not want to be separated and scattered. What they were really looking for is universal peace. And I would argue that's the context that we have from that period onwards. I mean, pick any period of human history, and you'll discover that you'll find this goal, this quest of discovering universal peace. So it's not so much that they wanted to build this gigantic city and this tower. Rather, what God was dealing with was this problem of humanity of wanting to pursue universal peace outside of submission to the one who would provide that universal peace. God is not against us finding universal peace. He's against us finding it from the wrong source. And it's kind of like what we've been talking about in our creation model here. God is in the business of delivering us from what we want to give us what we need. I mean, we're pursuing this universal peace. That's what we want, but it's not what we need. We need to first get our peace with God. That's the point that Jesus made. I've not come to bring peace, political peace. I've come here to bring personal peace, and there will be no political peace until people first make their peace with God. That's got to be the step towards universal peace. But hey, listen to the speeches of the United Nations. What we have are the leaders of the world trying to pursue universal peace without first making their peace with God. And it's the same problem we have here in the plains of Shinar. We're going to pursue universal peace, and their strategy for universal peace, we will not scatter. We will not multiply and fill the earth. We're not going to move. We're all going to remain here so that we can be one people at peace with one another. And they thought this is the way to solve their human problems. But there's a real problem with universal peace. It's something I talk about in the Genesis question. When we get back next time, we'll pursue that a little there. What are the problems with universal peace? And I think that's a message that needs to be preached on the floor of the United Nations. That the greatest risk or greatest danger for humanity is that we will find universal peace without first making our peace with Jesus Christ. The worst thing that could happen to the human species is that we actually achieve our goal of universal peace. And of course, the reason why God acts swiftly here is, hey, we already had the problem of the flood. And the problem of the flood is we had universal peace in the days before the flood. And that universal peace led to the last loss of personal peace, as we mentioned. This is an era when 19 out of 20 people minimum were dying a death of murder. And yet the world was at peace. You know, people think, wow, this universal peace is great. But, hey, if you got people murdering one another to that degree, this isn't so wonderful. Those are the dangers of universal peace. Yes. I mean, you've already hit it very well, Ross. The rebellion is that blatant. God gave a direct command. It's the most repeated command we find in Scripture. They clearly understand the command. They know the command is from God. And they say, we're not going to do it. They literally shake their fist at God and say, no, we're not going to do what you want. We're going to do what we want to do. We know what's best for ourselves. We need universal peace, and we're going to get it. And God, knowing better and saying, hey, you guys should already know what's happening. Just look a few years back. You had universal peace. Look what happened. Do you want this to happen again? But evidently the rebellion is so extreme here. God says, look, they're not going to listen to any instruction. I'm going to forcibly scatter them over the face of the earth. End of debate, end of discussion. They're going to obey my command whether they like it or not. And so he literally forcibly scatters humanity over the face of the earth. Well, I think that's definitely part of the equation, that when people are scattered and there isn't universal peace, people will tend to recognize that, hey, I need to depend upon my Creator. So yeah, you're right. We have all these stories of how wild it was on the frontier, but a lot of people were praying on the frontier. They had to, because their lives were at stake. So likewise, when people scatter and leave the security of their home, their nation, and have to found a new home and a new nation, they find themselves more dependent on God. That was true of our own nation. When our nation broke away from Britain, the leaders of this nation really felt in a very deep way their dependence upon God, because they were on their own. We got to do this. We can't get help from Mother Britain anymore. We got to do this on our own. There was a hand over here. That's exactly the point. Peace without peace with God leads to horrible things. I mean, even our own lifetime, we've seen the consequences of that. I mean, you look at the Soviet Union. They'd closed their borders off so that there was universal peace within the Soviet Union. But look what happened to the citizens. And that's really the problem we're going to address next time, is that the problem with universal peace is there's no competition for the citizens of that universally peaceful nation. And where there's no competition, where there's no free market for the people, then we shouldn't be too shocked that the sin of humanity leads to oppression. And so that's the problem with universal peace. Universal peace outside of the authority of Jesus Christ leads to oppression, just in the same manner that when a company gets total control over a product, rather than saying, well, let's give the customer a good deal, no, they tend to take advantage of the customer. And that's why our nation has antitrust legislation. Likewise, what we're saying, Genesis chapter 11, is basically God's antitrust legislation. We need to put in a free market. That's why we need nations, plural, rather than one nation. With nations, plural, you've got a free market situation for the citizens. That's ideal. And, you know, if people aren't able to move, then it doesn't work either. And that's another reason. God wanted to get people in the habit of moving. We're going to scatter. And if you, people are able to move freely, then there is less potential for the oppression of citizens. I think that's one of the wonderful things about the United States. We have the freedom and the means to migrate anywhere we want in our country, or to leave the country if we want. And so that puts a lot of motivation on the governments to say, let's not tax these people too much, otherwise they might all move to Nevada. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's the new elitism. So, but to put it in context, we've always had a United Nations throughout all of history. There have been organizations that have had that as their goal, whether it be the Roman Empire, whether it be the European nations at the end of the Napoleonic War. I mean, that was their goal. So it wasn't just the United Nations and the League of Nations. There have been leagues throughout world history that have had this as their goal. And you know, it's interesting to put this in the context of the book of Daniel, because what the book of Daniel says is that this is the propensity of human nature to try to develop this universal peace. And so the angel prophesies to Daniel there will be four attempts to bring about this universal peace in the future. There will be groups of people who will get together to try to dominate the entire world to bring about universal peace. But he says, I'm going to send my angel to fight these leagues. And so the angel was first sent to fight the king of Babylon, then the king of Persia, then the king of Greece, and then the Romans. And what you see in each of these historical attempts is a movement to gain this universal peace. Yeah, I need to end. And but hey, have a look at the book of Daniel. And you know, one of the things I remember reading when I was a kid, the history of Alexander the Great and how he attempted to dominate the whole world. And you know, he wasn't content just to rule from India to Greece. He wanted everything. And so he got this strange flu virus at age 33 and died. And you say, you know, isn't that really weird how this guy at the very height of his military prowess suddenly gets his illness and is gone? But hey, Daniel predicted it. I wasn't aware that Daniel had predicted the death of Alexander, that he would die at the very height of his power, and his kingdom would be parceled out to four different individuals. And that's what happened. God broke up the Greek Empire into four different pieces. And was all there prophesied in the book of Daniel hundreds of years before it happened. Hey, let's close in prayer. Father, we want to thank you just how rich your word is in helping us to understand what's really going on in the affairs of men on this planet. I mean, we think we're in control of our destiny. We think that we are the ones that are directing the politics and the military maneuvering. But Father, we thank you that you're the one who's really in the control, that you are sending your angels to help deliver us from ourselves, to deliver us from our own desires. Lord, it is good that we have this desire for peace. Father, I pray you'd help us to direct that desire for peace in the right direction, Lord, that we would recognize the war that exists within ourselves and the need to make ultimately peace with you. So, Father, as we go about our ways, this next few days, weeks, and months, we ask that you would bring us across people who don't know you as Lord and Savior, who have this same passion for universal peace, for solving the problems of mankind. And Lord, I pray you would give us the opportunity to speak wise words in a gracious manner, to alert them to what you've already said thousands of years ago on the right way to really achieve personal peace and the peace for all humanity. In Jesus' name, amen.